or that showed the movie times.
Is it her? Faith asked. I can't...
Contact, Amanda said. Reuben Figueroa was standing up. The blonde with the tandem stroller stood on the other side of his table. Virginia Souza. The bottom girl had cleaned up well. She had dyed her hair honey blonde instead of bleaching it. Her makeup was understated. Her clothes accentuated her body but didn't show off too much. The ponytail gave her a more youthful look. She had been here before, taking time to study the other women to make sure she would blend in.
It's Anthony, Faith said.
She was right. Anthony was in the back of the stroller. He was dressed in pink. His legs were folded up underneath him. He was too big for the seat. His eyes were closed. They were shaped like Angie's. His skin was Angie's. His jeopardy was Angie's. Will clicked the radio. It's her. She has Anthony and an infant in the stroller. There's a second woman, probably back up three tables over, red shoes. Amanda said, Alpha team, Delta team, lockdown. She was closing off Legoland and the theater. Faith asked,
What are they saying? They're just standing there.
There was obviously a terse exchange going on between Reuben and Souza. Will saw the man's fists were tightly clenched. He kept looking at his son, then at Souza, like he couldn't decide whether or not losing Anthony was worth the pleasure of killing her.
She told him about her backup, Faith guessed. That's the only reason he's not on top of her. Red Shoes has to have a gun.
The iPad, Will said because he knew how these women worked. Souza wants to put Reuben on the hook for more money. She thinks she can get the iPad from Angie. Amanda cut in.
Brower texted. He can't hear them. He can't see what Red Shoes is doing. Can anyone see her hands?
Will told her. She's got her phone in her lap.
The purse, Faith said, because, like almost every woman there, Red Shoes had a purse that could easily accommodate a handgun. Phil Brower moved his chair, turning sideways. He was holding out his cell phone like he needed glasses to read something, using his peripheral vision to check on Green Jacket. She was still looking at the box office times. She still had her hands in her pockets. Faith said,
They're sitting down.
Reuben was in his chair. He didn't slump like before. His shoulders were straight. His legs were so long that his knees reached the other side of the small table. Souza had to keep her chair pulled back so that she could face him. Her mouth kept moving. She seemed blind to the effect her words were having. Faith said,
This is taking too long. She's worked men more than half her life. Why can't she see that he's about to explode?
Just go in. Deshaun sounded desperate.
Why aren't you guys moving? Nobody's armed.
You don't need a gun to throw a baby over the side of that balcony.
Jesus.
Will squinted at the infant in the front seat of the stroller.
Can you tell if the baby is moving?
Faith shook her head. Where's the diaper bag, the sippy cups, the extra blankets, the wipes?
You think it's fake?
Why would she bring a baby?
They're too much trouble. She said it again.
This is taking too long.
Reuben Figueroa seemed to be thinking this same thing. He had his hands clasped together in his lap. He wasn't reaching for his duffel bag. He wasn't talking. He glared at Souza as she lectured him. His anger was like a third person at the table. Will could almost see the crank on his back winding tighter and tighter. Souza either had no idea what she was doing, or she assumed that she had all of the power. Reuben Figueroa didn't like women with power.
Red Shoes is getting up.
The young woman stood and walked toward the escalator. Her phone was pressed to her ear. Will kept his eyes on Virginia Souza. She was warning Reuben about something, giving him an ultimatum. Her finger jammed into the air. She didn't seem to notice that her chair was moving, sliding her closer and closer to the table.
Will said, He's got his feet hooked around the chair legs.
What's he doing under the table?
Reuben's hands were working on something, peeling at something. Will put the radio to his mouth. It happened so fast that he didn't have time to press the button. Souza's chair yanked forward, pinning her to the back.
Reuben plunged a large knife straight into her throat. Her hands went up. He grabbed her wrists, holding them with one hand, while with the other he stabbed her belly again and again underneath the table.
Shit!
Faith hissed. Blood poured down Sousa's chair. She slumped over. Reuben stood with a duffel bag. He reached for Anthony.
Watch out!
Deshaun screamed. Green Jacket was drawing down on Reuben, double-barrel stainless steel snake slayer. Two shots from the Derringer would send 10 38 special-sized projectiles flying through the air. Phil Brower ran toward the woman, but it didn't matter. Reuben pulled a Sig Sauer out of his duffel and shot Green Jacket in the head.
Lock down, Amanda ordered. Now!
Will ran from the room, his rifle slamming into his back. Faith was on his heels. They were 50 yards from the atrium, one level below the food court. He felt like he was running on a treadmill as he circled the large opening. Every step forward took him 2 back. Faith bolted up the escalator to the 3rd floor. Will rounded the far side of the atrium. He slung around his rifle, slid across the floor on his knees, and took up position across from where Reuben Figueroa stood. The barrel of Will's rifle rested on the railing. His eye was to the scope. The safety was off. His finger stretched along the trigger guard. He took a breath. 40 yards. He could make the shot in his sleep, but Reuben held Anthony to his chest, his giant arm crushing his son's ribs. The muzzle of the Sig Sauer was pressed against Anthony's temple. Amanda said, "Drop it!" Her stance was wide. She had her revolver out, 15 feet from her target. Faith had stopped the escalator. She was lying flat to the stairs. Phil Brower was kneeling behind a table. They had formed a triangle, trapping Reuben inside. Like Will, they were all looking for a shot. Like Will, they were all coming up short. Anthony covered his father's heart, his lungs, his belly, any place that a bullet could stop him. Reuben screamed,
"Back the fuck up!"
Will looked through the rifle scope. Reuben's finger was wrapped around the trigger. One single twitch and Anthony's life would be over. Will knew that Amanda was going through the same checklist that he was. If she hit Reuben's leg, he could still pull the trigger. If she aimed for his head and missed, he could still pull the trigger. If she hit his head, he could still pull the trigger. If she miscalculated by even the smallest fraction, she could end up killing a 6-year-old boy. Amanda said, "You're surrounded. There's no way out. Get the fuck out of my way." Will tensed. Reuben had an athlete's reflexes. In seconds, he could flick his wrist and shoot Amanda, and Will would be left with the same bad choices. Reuben walked toward Amanda. He limped in his knee brace.
"Get back, bitch."
"You don't want to do this." Amanda backed up. Will's view was obstructed as she passed in front of the elevator.
"Put the gun down and we can talk."
Reuben kept walking, Anthony tight to his chest. Will moved counter to him, rifle up, praying for a clean shot. Reuben punched the button on the elevator.
"I'm walking out of here."
"Put the boy down," Amanda said.
"Put him down and we'll talk."
"Shut the fuck up!" The sound of his father shouting was enough to wake Anthony from his stupor. His eyes went wide as he realized what was happening. He started screaming, a high-pitched sound like an animal caught in a trap. The elevator doors opened. Reuben got on. Will had a straight line through the glass wall of the elevator. He still couldn't shoot. Even from this distance, he wasn't sure the bullet wouldn't pass through Reuben and kill Anthony. The doors closed. Will jogged back around the atrium. The elevator car passed to the 2nd floor. He ran toward the next escalator. The stairs were going up. Will shuffled down, his feet tripping on the metal treads. He grabbed onto the rails, lifted his legs, and hurled his body the rest of the way down. His feet hit the floor just as the elevator doors opened. Anthony was crying. He squirmed to get out of his father's arms. Reuben struggled to hold on to the kid and the gun. He was yelling at the boy to be quiet. Will ran at a crouch, using the back of the escalator for cover. The butt of his rifle was jammed into his shoulder. He kept one eye on the sight. Anthony kept flailing, arms wide. His feet kicked, landing a blow on his father's bad knee. Reuben dropped him.
Will swung around and pulled the trigger. The world stopped spinning. The butt of the rifle recoiled into Will's shoulder. There was a flash at the end of the muzzle, the cartridge ejected out to the side. The bullet sliced the dense air like a knife cutting open a bag of flour. Reuben Figueroa's shoulder jerked back. He slammed against the elevator doors and slid to the floor. Will followed him down, going to one knee. His trigger finger started to pull back again, but Anthony stopped him. Reuben had the SIG pointed at his son's back. His aim was steady. Will had put the bullet in the wrong shoulder. Reuben said, "Come here, boy." Will was 15 feet away from Anthony. Reuben was less than 2. "Anthony," Will said, "run." Anthony didn't move. Will slid his knee across the floor, trying to get a better angle. Reuben's flanks were protected by the deep elevator alcove. The only shot that could take him out would have to come from the front.
"Stop."
Reuben's eyes tracked back and forth between Anthony and Will and then Faith. She was on the other side of the escalator, another triangle, again with Reuben at the center. Will heard footsteps as more officers approached, but he didn't dare take his eye off Reuben Figueroa.
"Anthony," Reuben ordered. "Get over here, boy."
Faith said, "Anthony, sweetheart, come to me. It's okay." Will slid over a little bit more, his fingers tensed on the trigger. Reuben screamed,
"Now, goddammit!"
Anthony stepped back. Will took his finger off the trigger. Reuben wrapped his injured arm around his son. Anthony fell into him, his head blocking his father's face. The SIG pressed at the boy's temple. Anthony didn't struggle. He didn't speak. He had learned to be still when his father was angry. All of his fear channeled into his lip that quivered like his adoptive grandmother's, and the look of resignation in his eyes that he'd inherited from Angie. When she talked to Will about the abuse, she never talked about it. She only gave advice. "All you have to do is wait until it's over." Anthony was waiting for the inevitable. The screaming, the hitting, the black eye, the split lip, the sleepless nights as he waited for the door to open.
"Back away."
Reuben had to rest the side of his hand on his son's shoulder. He was panting hard. Blood poured from the bullet hole just below his clavicle. They were at the same impasse as the one upstairs, only now Reuben was even more desperate. Will said, "Put down the gun. You don't want to do this."
"Shit."
Reuben's hand started shaking. Blood slipped down his other arm. The muscles were spasming, tensing his chest and shoulders.
"What did you hit me with?"
"Hornaday 60-grain tap urban. Tactical application for police." His eyelids were heavy. His face was slick with sweat.
"Reduced penetration for urban environments."
Will used his back foot to push his knee forward. He couldn't come from the side. He had to get closer.
"Sounds like you know your ammo. You see that snake slayer that bitch pulled? Probably had 410 bonds in the chamber." "Lucky I stopped her."
Reuben blinked sweat out of his eyes. Will wondered if the man's vision was blurring. There were a lot of important things near the clavicle. Subclavian arteries. Subclavian veins. Sarah would know. She would record the damage in Reuben Figueroa's autopsy, because if the man hurt Angie's grandson, he would not walk out of here alive.
"Let's talk this out," Will said. "You're gonna need surgery. I can help you." "No more surgery."
He shook his head. He was blinking more slowly now. His arm was not so tight around Anthony. The muzzle of the SIG had tilted upward, but Reuben could still put a bullet in his son's brain. Will moved closer. Faith made a noise. Anthony looked at her. Will did not. He knew she was trying to wave the boy over.
"Don't."
Reuben straightened the gun. Will asked,
"What's the trigger pull on that SIG? 5.5 pounds? 6?
Reuben nodded.
"Why don't you move your finger? You don't want to make a mistake."
"I don't make mistakes."
Will slid closer, 10 feet. If Reuben moved just a little to the side, Will was close enough for the headshot. To make one. To receive one. Will couldn't trust the gun in Reuben's hand. It was upstairs all over again. Reuben could flick it out and kill Will. He could flick it back and kill Anthony. Will said, "You're not doing too well, man."
"I'm not,"
he agreed. The arm around Anthony started to relax again. The boy could pull away, but Reuben could still shoot the gun. At Anthony. At Will.
"Let's talk this out," Will repeated. He pushed a few inches closer. The rifle was out in front of him, 39 inches of weapon. One hand on the grip, the other on the stock.
Will slid his hand farther down the barrel. His shoulder would dislocate if the gun went off. He curved his back, buying the illusion of extra space.
Reuben said, "I can't leave my boy alone."
Will couldn't look at the kid. He couldn't see Angie's eyes looking back at him.
"You don't have to take Anthony with you."
"There's nothing left for him," Reuben said. "Joe's gone. My career is gone. That video gets out and my freedom is gone."
Will said, "Do you see how close I am?"
Reuben's eyelids fluttered. He straightened the SIG.
Will said, "I can pull the trigger right now."
"So can I." Reuben's breathing was shallow. His skin had no color. Will could see every single pore in his face, every single follicle of hair.
"I'm not going to leave my boy alone."
He swallowed.
"Joe wouldn't want that. Her real mother left her. She would never leave her son."
Will pushed himself closer. He thought about why Reuben was doing this, how the loss of control had spun out his life. He asked,
"How do I stop this, Reuben? Tell me how to save your son."
"Who killed her?" Will tried to think of the best lie to tell him, the one that would keep him from murdering his son. That Joe was still alive, that Reuben had something to live for. That Joe was dead, but the woman behind her murder was in police custody. That she was Joe's mother, that she had tried to ransom her own grandson. Reuben was out of patience.
"Who, man? Who killed Joe?"
"The woman upstairs." He couldn't tell if he'd made the right choice, but he had to keep going. "Her name is Virginia Souza. She's a prostitute who met Joe in jail. They argued. Souza took out her revenge." To Will's great relief, Reuben started nodding, like that made sense.
"Was it over drugs?
What they fought over?"
"Yes."
Will moved another millimeter, then another. His hand slid farther down the barrel, too far to safely hold onto the stock. There was no way he could safely fire the rifle now. "Souza knew that Joe was rich, that she had money. She followed her to the party, she kidnapped her, she took Anthony." Reuben nodded again. The reason was obvious. His wife had hidden her addiction, she would hide other things.
"Bitch is dead now."
"That's right," Will said.
"Joe, too."
He stopped to swallow.
"She betrayed me.
Betrayed everything we had. She didn't listen to me.
That's what women do. They just take and take and spit you out like you're nothing."
The muzzle of the SIG had tilted up again, but again not enough to clear Anthony's head. Reuben was faltering. His muscles were twitching. His nerves were in array. His finger could pull the trigger by mistake or by design. Whether it was pointing at Will or at Anthony when it happened was going to be a delicate dance.
"Stop moving," Reuben said.
"I'm not moving." Will moved up. Reuben's throat flexed as he swallowed.
"She kept it from me. The pills.
She stole that video. I know she's the one who stole it.
Ruined my life. My son's."
He swallowed again.
"My son."
Will was close enough now. He could only grab one thing. The gun or Anthony. Anthony or Will. All it came down to was which direction the gun was pointing.
It's okay. Reuben was looking at Will now, a flatness to his eyes. His mouth gaped open. His lips were blue. He was having trouble getting air. He blinked, slow. He blinked again, even slower. He blinked a third time, and Will lunged forward, his arm swinging through the air, backhanding Anthony out of the way. Reuben's head exploded. Hot blood splattered Will's face and neck. Bone was inside his mouth, up his nose. His eyes were on fire. He fell back, dropped the rifle. He clawed at his face. Strings of muscle and tissue caught up in his fingers. He sneezed. Blood sprayed onto the floor. He could barely see it. He was standing, walking backward like he could get away from the carnage, but the carnage was all over him. Will! Amanda yanked him forward by his arm. He stumbled, tripping over his own feet. She kept pulling him, then dragging him across the atrium, down a corridor where he bounced off the wall. He was completely blind. Carpet was under his feet. He tried to open his eyes, but he couldn't. Splinters were ripping apart his eyeballs, shards of Reuben Figueroa's bone and teeth and cartilage. "Lean over." Amanda pushed him down. Cold water streamed into his mouth, his face. Chunks of gray matter slid down his skin. He saw light. He blinked. He saw white porcelain, a tall faucet. They were in the bathroom. He was leaning over the sink. Will reached for the soap dispenser. It ripped off the wall. The bag burst. He took handfuls of soap and scrubbed his face and neck. He ripped off his shirt. He scrubbed his chest until the skin was raw. "Stop," Amanda said. "You're going to hurt yourself." She grabbed his hands. She made him stop before he peeled the skin off his body. "You're okay," she told him. "Take a breath." Will didn't want to take a breath. He was sick of people telling him to take a breath. He stuck his head under a different faucet in a clean sink. He rinsed out his mouth. The water was pink when he spat it into the bowl. He rubbed his face, scratching the skin, making sure there were no more pieces of Reuben Figueroa in his eyes and hair. "Drink some more water." He picked something out of his ear. Red grit. Part of a molar. Will threw the tooth against the wall. He leaned his hands on the basin. His breath was like fire in his lungs. His skin burned. Phantom drops of blood slid down his face and neck. "It's all right," Amanda said. "I know it's all right." He closed his eyes. It wasn't all right. Blood was everywhere. In the sinks, pooling onto the floor. The bathroom was freezing. He was shaking from the cold. "Anthony," he clenched his teeth to keep them from chattering. "He's safe. Faith has him." "Jesus," Will mumbled. He tried to regulate his breathing, to get back some sense of control over his body. He squeezed his eyes shut. "I wasn't sure Faith had a line."
"She did. I did. All of us did, but he beat us to it."
Amanda started pulling paper towels from the dispenser.
"Reuben Figueroa killed himself."
Will's head jerked up in surprise.
"The second Anthony was gone, Reuben put the gun under his chin and pulled the trigger."
Will stared at her in disbelief. She nodded.
"He killed himself."
Will tried to play it back in his head, but all he remembered was the fleeting concern as he shoved Anthony out of the way that the kid would fall and hurt himself.
Amanda said, "You did everything right, Will. Reuben Figueroa made a choice."
"I could have saved him."
Will wiped his face with a paper towel. The rough paper was like a cat's tongue. He looked down, expecting to see blood, but finding only the dark stain of water. Was Faith wiping Anthony's face in another bathroom? When the gun had gone off, the boy had been standing as close to Reuben as Will had been. For how many years would Reuben's son feel the slick fibers of his father's brain dripping down the side of his face? How many nights would he wake up screaming, scared that he was suffocating on the gray matter and bone that he'd sniffed up into his nose?
"Will,"
Amanda said.
How could you have saved him?
Will shook his head. He had made the wrong choice. He'd felt it in his gut even as the lie had come out of his mouth.
Reuben would have put down the gun if I'd told him the truth about Joe. That she was alive. That he had something to live for.
He wadded up the paper towel into a ball.
You heard what he said about not leaving Anthony alone. That Joe wouldn't want that. No way he would have pulled the trigger if he'd thought there was still a chance that his family was intact.
Or he would have shot you instead. Or been shot by one of us because he stabbed a woman to death 2 floors above us. He shot another woman in the head. He beat his wife for nearly a decade. He threatened to murder his own son. Where are you getting this notion that there was some romantic bond between Reuben Figueroa and his wife that you could magically invoke and make everything better?
Will chucked the paper towel into the trash.
If you love someone, you don't go out of your way to hurt them. You don't torture them. You don't terrify them or make them live in constant fear. That's not how love works. It's not how normal people work.
Will didn't need Amanda to point out that there wasn't much daylight between Angie and Reuben.
Thanks, but I think I'm going to pass on today's parable.
Amanda didn't respond. She was looking at his bare chest, the round, perfect O's that the cigarettes had seared into his flesh, the black tattooing left by the electrical burns, the Frankenstein stitches around the skin graft from when a wound refused to close. Before Sarah, he would have scrambled to cover himself. Now, he was just intensely uncomfortable. Amanda unzipped her jacket.
I used to come watch you on visitation days.
Visitation days. She meant at the children's home. Will had always looked forward to the visits until he started dreading them. All the kids were bathed and trotted out for prospective parents. And then the kids like Will were trotted back in.
I couldn't adopt you. I was a single woman, a career gal. Obviously, I was unfit to take care of anything more than a pet rock.
She wrapped her jacket around his shoulders. Her hands stayed there. She looked at him in the mirror.
I stopped visiting because I couldn't stand the longing. Not my own, which was hard enough, but your longing broke my heart. You wanted so badly for someone to pick you.
Will stared down at his hands. There was blood crusted into his cuticles.
I picked you. Faith picked you. Sarah picked you. Let that be enough. Let yourself accept that you're worth it.
He used his thumbnail to scrape out the blood. His skin was still pink. He shivered again from the cold.
She's going to be alone.
Amanda helped him into the jacket.
Wilbur, women like Angie are always going to be alone. No matter how many people surround them, they will always be alone.
He knew that. He had seen it all of his life. Even when Angie was with him, she still held herself apart.
Do you think we have a case against her for letting Delilah die in the trunk of her car? With Jane Doe as our only witness? No security footage, no DNA, no incriminating fingerprints, no smoking gun, no corroborating testimony, no confession?
Amanda laughed at the futility.
It's Denny who's going to suffer. I can keep him out of jail, but he'll lose his job, his pension, his benefits.
Will didn't want to feel sorry for Collier, but he did. He knew too much what it felt like when Angie threw you to the wolves.
Let me get this.
She tried to zip the jacket. She couldn't get it closed past his chest. The bottom was too short. The waist hit him above his navel.
I'll have to buy you another shirt before you go back out there. You look like a Filipino sex worker.
She meant it as a parting shot, but he couldn't let her go yet.
It's never going to catch up with her, is it?
He said. The people she hurts. The damage she does.
Trust me, Will. Life always makes you pay for your personality.
Amanda gave him a rueful smile.
It catches up with her every single second of the day.
11 days later. Saturday. Chapter 14. Sarah stood in her kitchen, watching the noon news as she ate a bowl of ice cream. After 10 days of speculation, Dietmar Wittich was finally giving an interview. He sat with a scaled model of the scuttled All-Star Complex behind him, delivering a diatribe about how the project was still a good idea. He might as well have been speaking gibberish. The reporter clearly only cared about sentences that contained the words Rippy or Figueroa. Wittich said,
"The complex would bring thousands of jobs to the city."
Sarah muted the TV. Other than the German accent, she had no idea where Will got the Goldfinger reference. Wittich was much more of a Stromberg. She dumped the rest of the ice cream into the sink, probably not the best choice for lunch. But it beat day drinking. When she glanced back at the TV, the screen was split between Wittich and that video that was being called the Rippy Rampage. Sarah wanted to look away, but she couldn't. Hardly anyone in the world could. Someone at the GBI had leaked the file from Angie's iPad. Amanda was on the warpath, which to Sarah's thinking meant she was probably the culprit. Angie had been right that the video was damaging, though probably not for the reason she had assumed. The film that Ruben Figueroa had made of himself and Marcus Rippey raping a drugged Keisha Miscavige had shattered internet viewing records. Unfortunately, all that people could talk about was the last 3 seconds of footage when, off camera, a door is slammed open. A hand reaches out to swat Ruben's iPhone away, and a woman screams the beginning of what is obviously the word, "motherfucker." The blur of pink before the video goes black is almost lost to the naked eye. But slow down the frames, and you can see the custom-crafted Italian leather stiletto kicking Keisha Miscavige's head. The ostrich skin shoe is dyed bright fuchsia. There is a gold R embroidered on the toe. Will had recognized the shoe immediately. He had a thing for shoes. He remembered that LaDonna Rippey had worn the stilettos to the one and only interview her husband had submitted to during the rape investigation. Marcus Rippey was freely giving interviews now. He'd turned on his wife, insisting that he and Ruben had just been having a little fun with Keisha Miscavige. The video backed him up. Keisha was drugged, but showing no outward signs of injury before LaDonna entered the room. According to Marcus, it was LaDonna who had done the real damage. So here was Will's new case. LaDonna had beaten Keisha. LaDonna had choked her, punched her, strangled her over the course of 5 hours. LaDonna had left the bruises on Keisha's back and legs and put her into a coma that had kept her in the hospital for a week. The forensic evidence backed this up. LaDonna's DNA had matched the sweat and saliva found on the victim's body. Keisha's DNA was found in the spots of blood on LaDonna's pink shoes. The prosecution wasn't open and shut. With the Rippey's money, nothing was ever a sure thing. But there was also a documented pattern of behavior. LaDonna Rippey was a jealous woman. Will had found 3 previous out-of-court settlements where victims had been paid for their silence. A woman in Las Vegas was still managing to tell her story despite LaDonna breaking her jaw and busting out her teeth. Another woman in South Carolina from 15 years ago was shopping a tell-all book. There would be more because there was always more. It seemed like Marcus Rippey's wife was looking at serious prison time. Whether or not Marcus was looking at the same was up to a jury to decide. The world could come up with all kinds of excuses when a man raped and beat a woman. Not so much when a woman was the one doing the damage. Sarah couldn't let herself sink into this depressing quagmire again. She turned off the TV. She called up her song list and put on Dolly Parton. She kicked the vacuum into the kitchen. She rolled up her proverbial sleeves and started taking everything out of her cabinets so she could clean them.
This was back to her normal level of stress management, though Sarah had spent plenty of time watching Buffy on the couch and drinking way too much alcohol. Will had been tied up closing the Ruben Figueroa case and opening new ones against LaDonna and Marcus Rippey. His late nights and early mornings had him staying at his house so he wouldn't deprive Sarah of her sleep. They were depriving each other of much more than that. Yet another thing that was going wrong. Sarah knew from her first marriage that the only surefire way to stop having sex was to stop having sex. Not that sex would be any more than a temporary solution. There was still the larger issue of what happened with Angie and Will and Sarah. And Sarah couldn't fix that on her own. The phone rang. She bumped her head on a drawer. Sarah let out some choice words as she reached for the phone on the counter.
"It's me," Tessa said. "I'm in a phone booth. We've got 4 minutes before my money runs out."
Sarah turned off the music.
"Why are you calling from a phone booth?" "Because your precious niece dropped my cell phone down the hole in the outhouse."
Sarah covered her mouth to muffle the laughter.
"Yeah, it's really funny that my phone is encased in shit and I'm going to have to stick my hand down there to fish the fucking thing out."
Tessa's missionary work was more about helping people and less about watching her language.
"I am literally in the middle of nowhere. I can't just walk up to a Verizon store and buy a new one."
"Where is she now?"
"Probably scribbling in my books and cutting up my clothes," Tessa sighed.
"She's with her father, who is making sure I don't kill her. And don't tell me I was just as bad when I was her age. I already got an earful from Mama." Tessa had been just as bad, but mentioning their mother was enough to drain away any desire to tease.
"I got an earful, too."
"She's worried about you." Sarah pushed herself up onto the counter. "There's a fine line between worried and being self-righteous."
"What's that, Kettle? Pot can't hear you."
Tessa changed the subject before Sarah could come up with a snappy retort.
"Have you had the talk with Will yet?"
The talk. The reckoning. Sarah was dreading it as much as Will. She told her sister, "I've been giving him some space. All that stuff with Ruben Figueroa and Anthony and..." She didn't have to remind Tessa of the details. The story of the hostage standoff in the mall had made it all the way to South Africa. "I just didn't want to pile onto him. Sorry you witnessed a horrific suicide, but let's talk about our relationship."
"You'll have to get around to it eventually."
"What's the point?" Sarah asked. "What'll happen is I'll say what I have to say, and he'll nod a lot and look down at the floor or past my shoulder, and he'll rub his jaw or pick at his eyebrow, and at the end of the day, he won't tell me anything about how he's feeling because he thinks he can just pretend it away and we'll be fine."
"Oh," Tessa drew out the word. "You didn't tell me Will was a man. Now all of this suddenly makes more sense."
"Ha-ha."
"Sissy, you keep saying to me again and again that he won't talk, but what are you saying to him?"
"I told you I was giving him space."
"You know what I mean," she countered.
"I can see you being all stoic and logical and letting him think this is some sort of math problem that has an X or Y solution, when inside, you're about to die. Only you can't let him know that because you're worried about looking like some damsel in distress."
She stopped for a breath. "Look it, there's nothing wrong with being a damsel. It's not a man-woman thing, it's a human thing. You like taking care of him. You like feeling needed. There's no sin in letting Will have the same thing with you."
Sarah knew what was coming next before Tessa even said it.
"You need to show him how you feel."
"Tess, I just..." She had to tell the truth, if only to her sister. "I know this sounds petty, but I don't want to feel like I'm his second choice." Tessa's response was not immediate.
"Will is your second choice."
She meant Jeffrey.
"It's not the same. In a lot of ways, it's worse for Will. There's no question that you'd still be with Jeffrey if he were alive, but in Will's favor, Angie's still alive, But he's choosing to be with you, so it's really more like a divorce. And you have to put up with his bitchy ex-wife, which puts you in line with exactly half the female population.
Sarah leaned her head back against the cabinets. She stared out the windows in the living room. The sky was an almost painfully clear blue.
She wondered how Will was spending his Saturday. Their perfunctory phone call last night had been filled with a lot of noises about future plans that neither one of them seemed too excited about. Tessa said,
"Every person has baggage. You've got all your shit with Jeffrey. Lord knows I've got my shit. People have baggage. The next guy, if you move on, will have baggage. The Pope has baggage. Jeffrey had baggage. You didn't hold that against him."
"Because he belonged to me," Sarah said, and she understood that this was what hurt most. She was jealous. She didn't want to have to share any part of Will with anybody else. His mind, his heart, his body. She wanted him all to herself.
"Sissy, don't cry."
"I'm not crying," Sarah lied. Fat, stupid tears were rolling down her face. In the abstract, she could logic out all of the reasons why Will was wrong for her. But then she thought about losing him, and she could barely find a reason to get out of bed. The phone started beeping, giving them their 30-second warning that time was running out. Tessa said,
"Look, you know your choices. You can go find Will and tell him that you love him and that you want him in your life and that you're miserable without him. Or you can turn Dolly Parton back on and finish vacuuming out your kitchen cabinets."
Sarah looked around the kitchen. She really should stop being so predictable. "Is there a third option?"
"Fuck the hair off his balls," Sarah laughed.
They both silently waited for the three quick beeps on the phone before the line was cut. Sarah hung up the phone. She looked out the windows again. A bird floated through the air. Its wings fluttered in the breeze. Sarah missed having bird feeders in her backyard. She thought about the open houses she had looked at with Will a lifetime ago. She had pictured her weekends spent filling up hummingbird feeders and doing laundry and reading on the back porch while Will worked on his car. When they were all standing in the waiting room in the Grady ICU, Angie had told Will that she wanted to give her daughter a happy ever after. Sarah could give that to Will. She could give him everything, if he would only let her. The dog stirred from the couch. They wandered toward the door. Their tails wagged because they knew the person on the other side. Sarah's first thoughts were purely instinctive. Her hair was packed into a granny bun. She was sweating from being inside the cabinets. Her face was red from crying. She was wearing a ratty T-shirt and cut-off jeans. Even her bra was baggy. They had not been in a relationship long enough for Will to see her this way. She jumped down from the counter with the hope of making it to the bathroom before he opened the door. She made it to the living room. "Hey." Sarah turned around. He had a bunch of takeout menus in his hand. "These were in the hall. My neighbor is out of town." He dropped the menus on the dining room table. He held up his key to her apartment. "Is using this still okay?"
"Of course."
Sarah pulled at the cutoffs. She straightened her shirt. Will had obviously come from home. He was in jeans and one of his running shirts. Tessa's third option flittered through her mind. He said, "Faith just called me. Kip Kilpatrick died about 20 minutes ago." Sarah knew the man had been in the hospital for the last 24 hours. His symptoms were all over the place. Did they ever figure out what was wrong with him? He ingested high amounts of ethylene glycol. It's found in antifreeze and transmission fluid. Sarah remembered the distinctive red bottle in the back of Angie's trunk.
"She'll get away with it, won't she?"
"I don't care. I mean, I care because a man died, even though he was a prick." He shrugged. "Faith says it was the sports drink. It's red, the same as the transmission fluid, and apparently the taste is sweet, so Kilpatrick wouldn't have noticed it. Half the bottles in his office mini-fridge were spiked."
Clever.
Yeah.
They both went silent. Sarah felt like she had had some variation on this conversation for the last week and a half. They talked about something terrible that Angie had done. They talked about work. One of them said something about grabbing a meal, over which they would have an even more stilted conversation. Then Will would make an excuse about needing to go home so that he could finish some paperwork. And Sarah would go home and stare at the ceiling. She said, "So what else? It's lunchtime. Are you hungry?"
"I could eat."
"There's nothing in the house. I'll need to shower if we go out."
"I miss you."
Sarah was shocked by his directness.
"I miss your voice. I miss your face."
He walked toward her.
"I miss touching you, talking to you, being with you."
He stopped a few feet away.
"I miss the way you rock your hips when I'm inside of you."
Sarah chewed her lip.
"I've been trying to give you some time, but I feel like that's not working. Like I should just start kissing you until you forgive me."
If only it was that easy.
"Babe, you know I'm not mad at you."
He put his hands in his pockets. He didn't look at the floor. He didn't look past her shoulder.
"I've got a court date at the end of next month. There's something called a divorce by publication. You put a notice in the newspaper, and if you don't hear back in 6 weeks, the judge can grant you a divorce."
Sarah felt her brow furrow. "Why didn't you do this before?"
"My lawyer said it would never happen. Judges don't like to do it that way. They rarely sign off on it."
He said,
"I asked Amanda to pull in a favor and find me a judge who would."
Sarah knew how hard it was for Will to ask for help. He said,
"I'm sorry I kept things from you. I know my not telling you stuff is a big thing, and I'm sorry."
She didn't know what to say except, "Thank you."
He wasn't finished. "The way I grew up, you had to hide the bad things. From everybody, it wasn't just about people liking you or not liking you. If you acted out or said something wrong, it got passed on to your social worker, and your social worker put it in a file, and people, potential parents, they wanted normal kids. They didn't want problems. So you had a choice. You either let yourself be really bad, like to let them know that you didn't care whether or not they chose you, or you kept your problems to yourself and hoped."
Sarah didn't dare answer. He so rarely talked about his childhood.
He said, "With Angie, anything I told her, she would find a way to throw it back in my face. Find a way to hurt me with it, or make me feel stupid, or..."
He shrugged, likely because the possibilities were endless.
"So I kept it all inside. No matter how important or inconsequential, because that was how I protected myself."
He still did not look away.
"I know you're not Angie, and I know I'm not a kid living at a home anymore, but what I'm saying is that it's a habit I have, the not telling you things. It's not a character trait. It's a flaw, and it's something I can change."
"Will..." Sarah didn't know what else to say. If he had told her all of this 2 weeks ago, she would have thrown herself into his arms.
"I got you this."
He took a key out of his pocket. He slid it across the counter.
"I changed the locks. I installed an alarm. I changed the combination on my safe. I took myself off everything that has to do with Angie."
He paused again.
"I understand that you need time. But you need to understand that I am never, ever going to let you go. Not ever."
She shook her head at the pointlessness. "I appreciate the sentiment, but there's more to it than that."
"There really isn't," he insisted, the same as he always did. "We don't need to hash it out because all that matters is how we feel about each other, and I know that you love me, and you know that I love you.
All that Sarah could see was a giant circle. He was apologizing for not talking about things, then saying that they should not talk about things. "Anyway," he finally said, "I'm gonna leave now. Give you some time to think about this. Maybe start missing me, too." His hand rested on the doorknob. "I'll be here when you make up your mind." The door clicked shut behind him. Sarah stared at the door. She shook her head again. She couldn't stop shaking her head. She was like a dog with a tick in its ear. He was so infuriatingly elliptical. "I'll be here when you make up your mind." What did that even mean? Here, as in the general, "I'm here for you," or here, as in actually physically waiting right now in the hallway for her decision? And why was it solely her decision in the first place? Shouldn't the future of their relationship be something they decided together? That was never going to happen. She turned back to the kitchen. Pots and pans were scattered on the floor. The vacuum hose was full of dog hair. She would have to clean it out before she let it touch the cabinets. Or she could just give up on today. Take a shower, get on the couch, and wait for a reasonable hour to drink. The dogs followed her to the bathroom. She turned on the shower. She took off her clothes. She watched the water fall, but didn't get in. Will's words played on an endless loop in her head. The memories worked at her irritation like a match striking flint. All that he'd offered her were Pyrrhic victories. He was finally divorcing Angie, but Angie would still be around. He had changed his locks, but Angie would find a way inside just like she had before. He had gotten an alarm. Angie would know the code, just like Will had known the code to unlock her cell phone. He'd said that he was never going to leave Sarah. So what? Neither was Angie. This was just more of Will's fairy tale thinking that all he had to do was wait it out and everything would magically be okay. Sarah turned off the shower. She was so frustrated that her hands were shaking. She put on her robe as she walked back into the bedroom. She picked up the phone to call Tessa, but then she remembered the outhouse. And then she realized that calling her sister was pointless because Tessa would only say the obvious. In his usual roundabout way, Will had just offered Sarah everything that she had wanted from him for the last year, and her response was to let him walk out the door. Sarah sat down on the bed. "Dumbass," she thought, but she didn't know whether she meant herself or Will. She had to look at this logically. Will's earlier declarations could be interpreted one of two ways. One, he was going to try to be more open, but he would rather stick needles in his eyes than talk about their relationship. Two, why would they talk about what they wanted when they already had everything that they needed? One and two. X and Y. "God damn it," Sarah muttered. The only thing worse than her mother being right was when her little sister was. Sarah stood from the bed. She cinched her robe tight as she walked back up the hallway. She passed through the living room. The dogs followed her to the door. Their ears perked when Sarah wrapped her hand around the knob. Her resolve started to slip. What if Will wasn't standing there when she opened the door? Too much time had passed. 5 minutes? 10? He wouldn't still be out there. What if here meant somewhere else? Logic had failed her, so she had to rely on fate. If Will wasn't in the hallway, she would take his absence as a sign that it wasn't meant to be, that she was a fool, that Angie had won, that Sarah had let her because she was too busy obsessing about what she thought she wanted rather than stopping to appreciate what she had. Show him how you feel. Tessa had told her to be more vulnerable. There is nothing more vulnerable than opening a door without knowing what would be on the other side. Sarah loosened her robe. She unpinned her hair. She opened the door. Epilogue.
Angie sat down on a wooden bench in the park. The slats were ice cold. She should have worn her coat, but the January weather was that weird mix of freezing in the shadows and burning hot in the sun. Angie had purposefully chosen a bench shaded by the trees. She wasn't hiding, but she didn't want to be seen. Her vantage offered a clear view of Anthony on the other side of the park. Her grandson. Not for real, but technically. He was on the swing set, surrounded by at least 10 other kids. His legs were straight out, his head leaned back. He was giggling as he tried to climb higher and higher. Angie was far from an expert, but she knew that this was how a 6-year-old was supposed to behave. Not sitting against the wall, watching other kids have fun, but out there in the middle of it, running around, happy like the rest of them. She hoped the boy would hold on to his happiness for a good long while. 6 months had passed since Reuben Figueroa had killed himself. Anthony's mother had almost died. He had been held by a stone-cold bitch for 2 days. They had moved away from Atlanta, back to Thomaston, where his mother's people were. He was in a new school. He had to make new friends. His father was still in the news as more and more of Reuben Figueroa's sins emerged. But here Anthony was, kicking it on the swing. Kids were like rubber bands. They snapped back quickly. It was only when the years started to roll by that they retracted from the memories. Was Joe still retracting? Angie looked past the swing set. She studied the group of mothers at their usual picnic table. Joe was sitting with them, but on the periphery. Her arm was in a sling strapped low on her waist. Angie didn't know the prognosis, but she took it as a good sign that Joe's hand was still attached. She also took it as a good sign that Joe had finally joined the other women. The park was a regular afternoon event. Joe had held herself apart for months, politely smiling, nodding over a newspaper or a book from several picnic tables away. That she was actually sitting at their table now, that she was looking at them, talking to them, had to be progress. Angie hadn't talked to her daughter since the night Delilah had tried to murder her. At least, not so Joe could hear. The last thing Angie had told Joe as she dropped her off at Grady was a list of instructions. Angie had already called Denny on the way to the hospital. Ing was there, too, so they had come up with a script for Joe that would pass for credible. That Joe's boyfriend had hurt her, that he had disappeared, that she would not give his name, that she didn't want to press charges, that her name was Delilah Palmer. Joe had played her part well, but she didn't know about the other things that Angie had done, like cleaning up the mess at the crime scene, using her cop training to hide everything in plain sight, like taking Delilah on the last, most miserable ride of her life. Angie still shuddered if she thought too long about the things she had done to Delilah's body. Not letting her die, because the bitch deserved that. But the cutting. Sure, Angie was dangerous, but she wasn't sick. The important thing was that the ends justified the means. Joe was living proof of this. Literally. She was living. The rest of it? Angie didn't know. Joe's hand would hopefully heal, but some wounds stayed open no matter what balm you tried. Angie could only guess what was going on in her daughter's head right now. Joe would still be feeling guilty about Reuben. Guiltier still that she was relieved to have him gone. She would be worried about Anthony. The short-term damage, the long-term damage. She wouldn't yet be worrying about herself, but she would be feeling exposed, because the entire world knew what her husband had done to her. To Anthony, to Keisha Miscavige, to other women, because in the ensuing months, victims had started coming out of the woodwork. Marcus Rippey and Reuben Figueroa had taken their show on the road, drugging and raping women across the country. There might be as many as 30 victims. Angie wondered if Joe took some kind of comfort in knowing that Reuben never beat the women he raped. That was only something special he saved for Joe. If you were keeping score, and Angie was the type to do just that, Keisha Miscavige was the real winner.
The fact that any person with a computer could Google her gang rape had not cowed the girl. Angie had